Let's turn now to Romans chapter 13, verses 8 to 14. Now, we're looking at these closing chapters of Romans, chapters 12 to 15. I think we may stop here, actually, and not go into chapter 14. I haven't finally decided that yet. But I do want to start a series on Ecclesiastes after Easter. I've been working up to this for 30 years. And I now feel that I'm almost ready to preach on Ecclesiastes. And it's the sort of series where, you know, you could bring complete sceptics, because Ecclesiastes, the author is a bit of a sceptic, actually. You could bring complete sceptics. And it'll be partly, at least, evangelistic. A lot of it will appeal to people who aren't believers. But it'll be useful for you lot as well. It's a great book, Ecclesiastes. I'm getting quite hooked on Ecclesiastes. I want to start that after Easter, so I may stop this series at the end of this morning's sermon. Okay, now these chapters 12 to 15 of Romans, I've described them as a manual of Christian conduct. Paul is telling his readers how Christians live. And if you can remember back to chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, he tells us there that we're to offer ourselves to God as sacrifices. We're to be living sacrifices. And this offering of ourselves to God is in response to Jesus' sacrifice for us. It's in response to the gospel. It's the gospel that saves us. But saved people offer themselves to God, as it puts it at the end of that great hymn, "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross." Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were an offering far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. So in response to the cross, we offer ourselves to God. And we offer ourselves to God to live a life, the rest of Romans 12 tells us, of sincere love. Sincere love for others, both inside and outside the church. Sincere love, says Paul towards the end of chapter 12, even for those who hate us and who want to harm us, or may even have harmed us. Sincere love even for them. And then last week we looked at chapter 13, verses 1 to 7, where Paul tells us about how Christians conduct themselves with regard to the governing authorities, the state. And now, in this passage, he returns to the general theme of Christian love. So that's our theme again this morning, the life of love. Now, he's just been saying in the first half of the chapter that we're to be good citizens and we're to pay our taxes and we're to fully meet all our obligations towards the state, paying all our debts, all our taxes, all our revenue, as he puts it, all our debts. So this passage says, verse 8, let no debt remain outstanding. Let no debt remain outstanding. Now the Authorized Version translates that, owe no man anything. And because of that AV translation, some Christians have taken the view that it is wrong to borrow money under any circumstances. Owe no man anything. I know one family, not in Kendal, who will not take out a mortgage, but will only rent property because the Authorized Version of Romans 13:8 says, owe no man anything. It's bad news for people who work in mortgage offices, isn't it, really? Well, for most of us, I think this is unrealistic. Most of us have probably got mortgages. And most of us have probably bought other things in that way as well. And the NIV is much to be preferred. Let no debt remain outstanding. In other words, let no debt go unpaid. Pay all your debts promptly, the Apostle Paul is saying. So if you do take out a mortgage, make sure that it's one you can afford. Paul is saying that Christians will be prudent and wise financial planners. We won't take on more debt than we're sure that we can handle. And this is extremely important and very relevant for us today, because we're living in a debt culture. Students have massive overdrafts, most of them. And they start their adult lives in debt. And it's virtually taken for granted that this will be the case. In fact, it's almost inescapable. It's virtually inevitable that most of us will start our adult lives with massive debts. And at least until recently, one bank after another and one credit card after another has vied with each other to try to coax us to take out more debt with them. I've noticed that I'm not getting quite so many letters to that effect through the postbox at the moment. And more people are finding, or have found, that they've taken on too much and they can't cope. So let's not buy into this culture of debt as Christians, this culture of instant gratification. Have it now, pay later. We mustn't take on more debt than we know we can afford to pay off. Now, it may be that there are people here who are in trouble over this. It's not something that you should feel you can't talk about to somebody. And there are Christian organisations that could help you. In fact, one of the things I sometimes dream of is sending one of our own members on some sort of debt counselling course, so that we actually have somebody in the church who could counsel our own members if necessary, but even perhaps have a ministry to others outside the church, helping them with this very, very relevant issue. I don't know whether anybody else ever dreams about that, but it's a little dream I've had from time to time. If anybody would be interested in being sent on a debt counselling course, or if anybody knows of anybody who offers debt counselling courses for people who want to do that sort of thing, do talk to me about it sometime. Okay. So, Paul says, pay all your debts. But he goes on to say, in verse 8, there's one debt you'll never be able to pay off. There's one debt we'll never be able to pay off. And that's the debt of love that we owe our fellow human beings. Verse 8, let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. You see what he's saying there? He's saying, look, you can pay off your bills and forget all about them. You can pay your taxes and forget all... No, that wouldn't be right to say that. I was going to say, you can pay your taxes and forget all about them. What a ridiculous thing to say. You'll never be able to forget about taxes. They'll even get you after you're dead. You can pay off your debts. You can pay off your taxes. And nobody can demand any more of you. You've met all your obligations. But Paul says here that we will never be able to say that we've loved our neighbour enough. We'll never be able to say that no more is required of us as far as loving our fellow human beings is concerned. We'll never be able to say, well, he or she can't expect anything more from me. This is the one debt that Christians will never be able to pay off. Actually, there are other debts in Romans that Christians can't pay off. There are actually four. I don't know whether you've noticed that. There are four debts in Romans that Christians are to keep on paying, that Christians have an obligation to pay. In Romans chapter 1, Paul says he is a debtor both to the Jews and the Greeks and to the wise and the unwise. He has an obligation to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. to everybody. That is a debt you'll never be able to pay off. The debt we owe everybody, wise and foolish, Jew and Gentile, all nations, to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ to them. That's one debt we'll always have. In Romans chapter 8, he says he's got a debt to himself. He says, we are debtors not to the flesh, to give in to the lusts of the flesh, the desires of the flesh. But we are debtors to put to death the deeds of the body through the power of the Spirit. In other words, the debt of holiness that we owe to God. And we owe, Paul seems to be saying that to ourselves as well. God has given us his Spirit. Yes, the old flesh is still there, but we are indebted to ourselves to resist the flesh and to live a life in the Spirit. And then in chapter 13, verse 7, he says we've got to pay off our taxes and our debts. And here he says the debt to love our neighbour. So love for our neighbour is a solemn obligation which must be discharged. It's a debt. Let me remind you again, therefore, that Christian love is a solemn obligation. It is a debt to be paid. That means that it's got to be more than just fuzzy feelings. After all, we don't pay our debts when we feel like paying them, do we? Nobody writes paying debt songs, do they? Nobody writes songs about paying their debt. You pay debts on time whether you feel like it or not. And Paul says that love for our neighbour is a debt that we pay whether we feel like it or not. Now, of course, feelings of affection and sympathy and compassion are very important and will usually be present. But sometimes we may not feel particularly like helping a brother or sister today. It might be just a bit inconvenient. Or sometimes we may not feel like doing good to someone who has hurt us or who has harmed us. But we do it anyway, whether we feel like it or not. Because it's a debt. And we don't wait to pay our debts until we feel in a kind of debt-paying mood. We pay our debts. Because it's right to pay our debt, and wrong not to. And we love our enemies, because it's right to love our enemies, and it's wrong not to, says the Apostle Paul, whatever our feelings may be. Okay, so the continuing debt of love. And in the rest of the chapter, Paul tells us, first of all, about the obligation to love one another in the light of God's law. And then secondly, the obligation to love one another in the light of Christ's return. First of all, the obligation to love one another in the light of God's law. Well, it's very significant, this, because in chapters 1 to 11 of Romans, Paul has told us that the law can't save us. God's law cannot save us. We've all broken it. It's a broken law. In fact, one of the interesting things that Paul says in Romans is that God's law actually makes things worse, believe it or not. God's law just gives our sinful natures, which are hostile to God, the opportunity to express themselves in definite, specific acts of disobedience. If there wasn't a law, if there were no prohibitions, we might have a sinful nature that hated God. But that hatred would not have the opportunity to actually exercise itself in acts of disobedience. So Paul says in Romans, where there's no law, in a sense there's no sin. So all the law does for sinners is actually stir up that hatred, that hostility to God, in definite acts of disobedience. So the law is the last thing that sinners need as far as salvation is concerned. In fact, salvation is not by the law, it's actually from the law. This accusing, condemning law that we have broken. And having said that, and having told us that God in his grace has found a way of saving sinners without the works of the law, through the obedience and the death of the Lord Jesus Christ, having said that in chapters 1 to 11 of Romans, he then says that now that we are saved, now that we're free from condemnation, now that we're God's children, we will want to obey God's law. After all, God's law is simply the expression of his character. It's simply the expression of his will. It's how he wants people to live. And his character hasn't changed just because we've become Christians. And we now therefore want to please him out of love and not out of self-righteousness and fear. So, the law, which used to condemn us, is now our guide as Christians. And what does God's law demand? Well, says Paul, in a word, God's law demands love. Verse 8, he who loves his fellow man has fulfilled the law. Verse 10, love does no harm to its neighbour, therefore love is the fulfilment of the law. So what does God's law demand? In a word, it demands love. If we loved our neighbour, says Paul, we would fulfil the law. And Jesus said exactly the same thing. He said, if you want to obey God's law, if you want to obey God, then God's law can be summarised as love for God with all our heart and soul and mind and strength, and love for our neighbour as ourselves. So love is the fulfilment of the law. Okay, if love is the fulfilment of the law, if God just wants us to love one another, why doesn't he just leave it at that? Why do we have the Ten Commandments? Why doesn't he just say, love one another? Why do we have the Ten Commandments? Because God needs to spell out what love means. It needs to be spelled out for us what love for our neighbour means. So, you shall not kill. To kill someone is not to love them. Well, you might say, we don't need to be told that. Nobody needs to tell me that to kill somebody is not to love them. Hang on a minute. What about mercy killing? What about people who say, well, the most loving thing to do for this person is to kill them? There are people who say exactly that, increasingly in our society. The most loving thing to do for that old person who hasn't got much of a quality of life is kill them. Do with animals, isn't it? Take them to the vet puts them down. Why don't we do the same with old people? Why don't we do the same with people who don't have much of a quality of life? Isn't that the most loving thing to do? Paul says, love does not kill. So that needs to be spelled out for him. Love does not commit adultery. Hang on. What about the adulterer says, what about my feelings? What about my feelings for this other woman? I happened to be in the room once. I don't watch soap operas. I don't watch any soap opera, okay? I happened to be in the room once when, honestly, when there was a soap opera on. I don't think it was my house either. It was somebody else's house. And I heard somebody who was wanting to commit adultery say, I can't help the way I feel. We can't help the way I feel. So it's all right. It's going to be all right because we can't help the way we feel. Isn't the most loving thing to do in certain circumstances to commit adultery? After all, what about these wonderful feelings that I've got for this other woman and her feelings for me? And, well, my feelings for my wife aren't quite the same as they perhaps used to be in days gone by. Isn't it the most loving thing to do just to commit adultery? Paul says, never. Somebody else used to say that, who was on the television recently. obviously, some of you there don't know who I'm talking about. But Paul says, never. It is never right to commit adultery. No matter how you feel, it is never right to do it. Forget your feeling. It is never right to commit adultery. What about the feelings of the other woman's husband? What about the feelings of the other woman's children? What about the feelings of your own children? It is never right to commit adultery under any circumstances. Okay? So, it's not enough just to say love one another, because people could say, oh, well, love, yes. God has to say, don't kill, ever. Don't commit adultery. Do not steal. Steal is a most unloving thing. It is an act of sheer self-centeredness to take what belongs to somebody else for myself. That is self-centeredness. That is not love under any circumstances. Love gives. It doesn't steal from other people. It gives to other people. And love does not bear false witness against its neighbour. To do that is to destroy the most valuable thing your neighbour possesses, his reputation, his good name, which Ecclesiastes says, it's more precious than perfume, a person's good name. And when you bear false witness against a person, you take the person's reputation away. You destroy the person's good name, which is a terrible act of unlove. And love doesn't covet what a neighbour possesses. It does not covet what a neighbour possesses or what a neighbour has achieved. And it doesn't resent that neighbour or envy that neighbour because of the person's possessions or achievements, even though they may surpass your own. That's not love. So love does not cover. So what does God require of us? God's law requires love from us. And as children of God now, who have been saved from the law, saved from the condemnation of the law, we now want to live a life of obedience to our Father's law. And that is what his law requires of us. And then secondly, our obligation to love in the light of Christ's return. At the end of the chapter, verse 13, we've got a list of rather ugly things which are incompatible with love. More things that are incompatible with love. Verse 13, let us behave decently as in the daytime, not in orgies and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and debauchery, not in dissension and jealousy. A list of things that are incompatible with love. Sins of self-indulgence. Self-indulgence in sex and alcohol. Orgies, drunkenness, sexual immorality, debauchery. Remember that this was the age of the Caesars. Remember Nero was the emperor. And he was guilty of virtually every kind of vice you can ever imagine. This was the age of the circus. You know, not the elephants and the clowns and so on, but the arena where you went to watch people kill each other, not just on video, but in real life, gladiators killing each other or fighting wild beasts. That was popular entertainment in Rome when Paul wrote this letter. That was the kind of society he lived in. And Paul says to these Christian readers, it's time we put that sort of stuff off. It's time we got rid of that stuff. This life of self-indulgence. And notice that along with those things, he puts dissension and jealousy, which are equally self-indulgent. We divide and fight in order to protect ourselves and to protect our position out of selfish ambition that resents people who we may perceive as rivals. Complete self-indulgence, which divides churches even, and he'll get onto that in the next chapter, chapter 14, when he talks about the Jews and the Gentiles. The Jews thinking it was wrong to eat certain stuff, the Gentiles thinking it was okay to eat certain stuff. What do you do when you've got both those people in the same church? That's probably why he mentions dissension and jealousy at this point. Equally self-indulgent, equally contrary to love. Okay, so in verse 13 there, he's really given us a list of what you might call the nightlife of the New Testament world. orgies, drunkenness, sexual immorality, debauchery, dissensions and jealousy. And Paul says it's time to put these things aside. He calls them the deeds of darkness. And the idea is of getting out of our night clothes and clothing ourselves, as he puts it, with the Lord Jesus Christ. Isn't that a beautiful expression? The end of verse 14. Clothe yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ. Let the first thing that people see of you and recognize of you be the Lord Jesus Christ. Be enveloped, surrounded by the Lord Jesus Christ. Clothe yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ. Put off your night clothes. Get up and get dressed. Put on the armor of light. Clothe yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ. Why does Paul tell us to put off our night clothes and to get up and get dressed? Because, he says, day is about to dawn. Verse 11. The hour has come for you to wake up from your slumber, because our salvation is nearer now than when we first believed. The night is nearly over. The day is almost here. So let's put aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. The night is nearly over. The day is almost here. He's talking about the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. He's saying that this age is like a long, long night. And the age to come, which will be inaugurated by the return of Jesus Christ, is like the dawn of a new day. Isn't that a lovely thought? The night has been long. The night sometimes seems endless if you can't sleep, if you're in pain, or if you've got something on your mind and you're tossing and you're turning and you can't sleep. The night seems endless. And then the sun comes up and morning arrives and you're really pleased to see it. Paul says it's time to get up. The day is about to dawn. Jesus is coming. Our salvation is nearer than when we first believed. He means by that ultimate, final salvation from sin and all its consequences. Jesus is coming with final, ultimate salvation. Salvation from death even. What a hope. What a blessed hope. The day is about to dawn, he says. Now, I'm sure you've all had the experience that, to be honest, me and June have had on at least one occasion. You know, you decide to sleep in. Don't very often sleep in, but you decide to sleep in. And that is always the morning when the postman has a package which is too big for the letterbox. And he knocks the door. He rings the bell, and there you are, still in bed. The first problem is who gets up. The second problem is getting up and getting something decent over you. To go, next problem is, we go to a front door like ours, is finding the key, actually. And, you know, you sort of go down, you open the door, there's the postman, and you sort of pretend you've been up for ages, you know? You sort of, hi! You pretend as if you've been up for at least an hour. Paul says, don't let it be like that when Jesus comes. Get up. Be ready. Be waiting. Be dressed. Be alert. Jesus is coming. Did he think that Jesus was coming in his own lifetime? There are some verses which suggest that he did. We that remain will be caught up to meet the Lord in the air. There are other verses which suggest that he didn't. I am now ready to be offered. The time of my departure is at hand. I've fought a good fight. I've finished the course. I've kept the faith. I'm going to die. I'm going to be executed. I know it. I'm ready. So there are some verses where Paul talks as if Christ might come in his lifetime. There are other verses when he talks as if he's pretty sure he's going to die. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is better by far. He didn't know, and neither do we. But he knew, and we know, that we are in the last day. We are in the last day. Because the last days is that whole period of time after the first coming of Jesus through to the second coming of Jesus. Messiah has come. And the next great event in God's schedule of salvation is the return of Jesus Christ. And therefore this is not a time to slumber. It is not a time to sleep. It is not a time to indulge in the world's nightlife. We should be up and clothed with the Lord Jesus Christ. And we should be ready to greet him when he comes. You know, there's a few young people here this morning. I was brought up in the sort of home and the sort of church where there were huge, endless lists of things you were not supposed to do. Places you would never go. You know, even say Carlisle United. I was not allowed to go to a football match when I was a kid on the grounds that people gambled over football pools and things, and therefore as a child I wasn't allowed to go to a football match. The cinema was absolutely out under any circumstances. There was a whole list of things you were not allowed to do. Monday morning at school, all the kids in my class were talking about what they'd seen at the Lonsdale on Saturday morning at the Miners, when all the kids used to go and watch cowboy films and cartoons in the cinema. I had no idea what they were talking about because I wasn't allowed to go. Didn't take that line with my own kids, they're still Christian. But I do wonder, young people, and older people too, whether the pendulum has swung too far. And I do wonder now whether Christian people find themselves in places where they shouldn't be. Where Christian young people are listening to stuff and doing stuff in nightclubs even and so on, that, you know, if you really prayed about it, you would probably admit that Jesus probably wouldn't want you to be there. I'd ask you to think about that. I'm not asking you to go back to the sort of upbringing I had. I'm not at all criticising that upbringing. I'm very, very grateful for it. I'm not asking you to go back to that necessarily, a very, very legalistic list of do's and don'ts. And as long as you did the do's and didn't do the don'ts, you know, you were all right. I'm not asking you to go back to that. But I am asking you to take care. Be careful where you go. Be careful what you listen to. And be careful what you watch on the television. I think it is true that the television gradually has just made us more and more tolerant of things which a generation ago would have shocked us. Would have shocked us to the core a generation ago. And now we watch it on the television and we hardly bat an eyelid. I would ask you to think about that. Jesus is coming. Let's put off the nightlife of the world. Let's put on the Lord Jesus Christ. So that when he knocks, we're up and dressed and ready to meet him.